ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
From an Ipswich fish and chip shop to the epicentre of Australian politics.
Please explain.
Pauline Hanson is
Maybe
One Nation.
This is the unlikely story of One Nation.
Well, I'm back.
Is it a passing protest vote or a permanent realignment of Australian politics?
Whether you love her or hate her, truth is stranger than fiction.
The Making of One Nation. To hear the full series, search for The Making of One Nation on ABC Listen.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. I'm David Marr. Forests are invading Italy. As young Italians abandon village life, trees are appearing in the fields. And for the first time since the Middle Ages, Italy has more woodland than farmland. It sounds lovely, but the transformation is fraught with difficulty. To the north, France is disentangling itself from US big tech companies, which have been servicing agencies of the state, even intelligence agencies, for years. The French call it asserting digital sovereignty. Germany is following suit. But first, from Canberra, Anna Henderson, Chief Political Correspondent for SBS. Anna, what did you make of the polls? Suddenly we have polls, we have news poll, and we have...
The Redbridge poll.
Redbridge, I'm sorry.
Yes,
Redbridge
in the Financial
poll.
Review. And then Roy Morgan later this afternoon. I'm surrounded by piles of newsprint with coloured bar graphs, and I'm ready to break it down with you as best I can.
What do they tell you?
Well, the first thing I think everybody has been looking at, and I actually, for the benefit of tonight, even made myself a little spreadsheet to compare all the primary votes because I need to see it all in front of me. The first thing that I think has been seized upon is that in all three polls, there's been a measurable dip in One Nation support. And so One Nation has been on this upward trajectory. And if you think back to where they've come from, it is pretty extraordinary. Like One Nation back at the last election on 6.4%, up to 31% in June. Now dipping back to 29. Now, this could be within the margin of error, but because we have three polls that have all shown the same slight reduction, that is interesting. And then the other thing on the One Nation front is that Pauline Hanson's net favourability has been measured. And this is a really significant move. So her net favourability was essentially neutral. It was on zero. It's dropped 10 points. So when we look at those movements, which are often around the two or three at a time mark, and sometimes could be within margin of error because of the sample size, this is a really big reduction.
A big drop.
And so point one is what's happening with One Nation. And
just before we leave One Nation, what about that figure in the news poll that showed that 59% of coalition voters are satisfied with Hanson's performance? What on earth does that mean? People who are going to vote coalition are nevertheless satisfied with Hanson's performance.
Do you think the two political parties are so different on key policies at the moment?
Well, no, they aren't. And I mean, that's one of the truly interesting things that's happening is that convergence.
But you're right, because you're saying that the voters who would normally vote coalition are liking, like this is a suggestion that they're kind of liking what they're seeing with some of the One Nation policies.
They're not going to change their vote
in real time.
They're not going to change their vote, but they like what they see.
But they are changing their vote, because one of the things about this polling data is that at least in the first couple of movements up from One Nation, they did appear to be stripping away from the Liberal Party and the National Party. And now we're into territory where it looks like when Labor's gone slightly back up. So Labor's now slightly ahead of One Nation, the primary vote again. That has not changed the Liberal vote in a positive way. So it looks like there were some people who were actually switching from Labor to One Nation, and now it looks like they've potentially flipped back.
Right. Now, What do you reckon about my theory about the standing of the Labour Party that these polls reveal? Because they look to me as though what they're saying is, despite the rage of News Corp and the Australian Financial Review declaring that the government was going to be torn to shreds over its tax changes, it hasn't been.
Okay, so to test your theory, I did go and make a few inquiries with the polling companies because we don't know all the things they do necessarily apart from the figures that we see, because often there are other things that they might do privately or things that they might test that don't get published. So I did ask for a little bit more information about what this tells us about Labor. Is it just sort of the reality that they've remained relatively stable? So in the May election last year, 34.6, and in this poll today, 33. So it is a good point that you make. What I am told, though, is that at this point, it's looking like from some of the other information they collect, the data along the way, it's not really that Labor is solid and that they have sailed through and, in fact, there's no impact on their vote. It looks like at this point that essentially, and I'm going to quote Sean Ratcliffe from Accent Research involved in the Redbridge poll and the Financial Review, that Pauline Hanson has essentially created a nice distraction from the budget. That's what it's looking like. Now, that's not set in stone and we can continue to test your theory over time, but it doesn't appear from the extra testing that they do that this is Labor actually emerging unscathed or bolstering support.
Not torn to shreds. Not remotely have the attacks on the tax policy done anything like that. And there's another thing as well that those figures show, which is that Labor maintains its advantage over the coalition as the party considered best to handle the economy. Now, that used to be the golden property of the coalition. It's now been in Labor's hands for years and the tax policies haven't budged it.
When you look at the economic management figure, so Labor's on 24, Liberals are on 21, Nationals are on 2. So actually, on that one, Labor's only just ahead, but I agree with you that in the past, the Liberal National Coalition has been the party of economic management. And this was also pointed out to me today in terms of what we learned from these figures, which is that we're at a stage where when you look at these issues, who is the best party to handle these issues? Cost of living, healthcare, housing affordability, rate of immigration, crime and public safety, economic management. None of the categories are led by the coalition. They are not considered the best party placed to deal with any of those major issues. So that is a huge problem for Angus Taylor and his colleagues to try and work out how they can claw back some ground and prove themselves to be more reliable.
Now, look, we should have appointed long ago the Macquarie Dictionary to the official judges of the true meaning of the term multiculturalism. This continues. It's rolling on still. And today, Andrew Hastie said this extraordinary thing. He says it's a loaded political term. What do you mean?
This is actually where Angus Taylor appeared to be going last week as well, with that now infamous press conference where he was asked about multiculturalism multiple times and he couldn't sort of confirm that he backed multiculturalism. He too has raised this issue of whether or not, in his view, the Labor Party has kind of co-opted the idea of multiculturalism and taken it to mean something else. And so, you know, that statement that he sent through, which we won't go through the whole thing again, last week, it has a mention of, so this is Angus Taylor, "We reject Labor's multiculturalism, which sees people held to different standards because of their cultural background." So this is the kind of semantic argument that's now happening around these definitions. The point I would also make is that it's all well and good for all these politicians to be defining multiculturalism and monoculturalism and framing this debate. And it does appear that despite One Nation kind of senior strategists thinking this is going to be a big winner for Pauline Hanson, and also that any time that anyone was talking about this debate, it was a winner for the One Nation team. I think once Pauline Hanson was in the Senate talking about the Socceroos, you could see maybe there was a little bit of a concern that this wasn't cutting through and they needed to try and retrace
the Socceroos, God bless them. Yes.
But let me say this. They can define it, but also voters will define it in their own way as well. And it sort of doesn't matter so much how the politician says the word should be used. It matters more what the voters think of that word and how they see it and what connection they have to it. And it seems like the connection to multicultural Australia is quite strong, and the monoculture idea is not resonating in the way that Pauline Hanson thought that it might. But there's still a long way to go on that. But I do think that when we look at the politicians defining it and getting to have a say about what they mean, we forget that the voter already has probably a pretty clear idea of what they think those words mean. But back on to Andrew Hastie. Do we want to continue with that?
No. Look, in the time we've got, I want to pursue the notion that the new president of the Liberal Party may be having a hand in this complicated, agonising debate.
Mm. So Angus Taylor is really under a lot of pressure over his performance at the moment because the polls aren't moving, because he's even back below where Susan Lee was when she was booted out for him to take her place. And so when we hear some of this discussion around, like, is multiculturalism still something that the coalition wants to embrace? Is there a concern about those words? It has started to raise questions amongst some members of the coalition about whether or not this is the hand and the view and the influence of Tony Abbott in the coalition again, because this feels to some of Angus Taylor's coalition colleagues like Tony Abbott's view, not Angus Taylor's view. So this is the worry that, in fact, as Angus Taylor has, you know, help to ensure Tony Abbott gets the presidency of the Liberal Party, it's not usually a role that necessarily has really strong power over the parliament. I mean, people can debate that, but certainly not recently has it been seen as having a directive hand, that Tony Abbott does want to get more involved. He does see his role as a bit of a saviour of the Liberal Party, but that he has very strong views which don't necessarily align with where the Liberal Party thinks it needs to go forward. And I think, not that I think they're necessarily linked, but today Melissa McIntosh, a frontbencher in the coalition, was talking about, you know, we need to rebrand, we need to move forward, we need to let go of the ideas of the past. It sounded kind of similar to some of those other concerns I've heard, which were related to Tony Abbott, that he is going to drag the party back to an era that he wants to position them in that Australia isn't in and perhaps never was in. So it's a challenging moment, and it may be that Tony Abbott actually starts to get more sitting members of the parliament wanting to speak up and maybe even challenge him directly on some of the things that he holds as very firm policy positions.
He can read figures, can't he? He can go to the polling and he can see that 70% of Australians support multiculturalism. That's 70%. That's a lot of people. It doesn't suggest there is a government to be formed by banging on and on about this issue.
I think there is just a bit of panic in the parliament and a bit of concern about how to strategically manoeuvre around what One Nation has been able to achieve. And so there are different views within the opposition about the best way to go. And also there is a view that there's still fertile ground from the coalition's point of view in pointing out what they see as sort of Labor's failures in the immigration space. But I don't think this week has, you know, shown so far to be the most graceful handling of that. But yeah, I think in the background, if Angus Taylor does appear to just be adopting policy positions and ideas that are very, you know, Tony Abbott coded, then we will start to see a lot more angst and perhaps sort of public rebukes are still to come.
Anna, thank you once again for joining us on Late Night Live. Anna Henderson, Chief Political Correspondent with SBS. Coming up, why France is ditching Palantir. Troubled by its entanglement with US big tech, France has cut ties with the surveillance company Palantir, which for the last decade has provided data analytics for France's domestic intelligence agency, DGSI. France is not alone in taking back its digital sovereignty in this way. Germany has also ditched Palantir, and agencies in both countries are cutting ties with Microsoft. Power, security, and money all have a role in this story, which has been covered for Politico in Paris by Océane Herrero, who joins me now. Océane, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Océane, remind us, what is Palantir and what did it do for the domestic intelligence agency?
Well, Palantir is a US company which focuses on data analytics and which works with a lot of intelligence services across the world. Germany was using those services as for recently, and France is trying to cut ties now with Palantir too. So it's a company that deals with very sensitive data. Of course, when you work on domestic intelligence. So it has been in the hot seat over the past few years and even more over the past few months as the discourse around sovereignty has taken importance in Europe. So today, it's really, contested in the public sphere. So that's where the debate is at the moment.
The contract with Palantir was renewed late last year. What has happened since then to reverse the view of the French government on the value of this company?
Yes, that's what's very surprising in the French case, because the contract, as you said, was renewed in last December, so it was very recent, over the argument that there was no competitor that had a product at the same level of quality as Palantir. But the French Prime Minister decided a few weeks ago to announce that the French intelligence services would progressively switch to another service, which is called Chaps Vision, which is a French company. So it has been a surprise for a lot of the ecosystem, actually, and even people at Palantir didn't hear about the news before the Prime Minister announcement. So it was very sudden for them, but at the same time, it's part of a larger strategy of the French government that knew that in the end they would have to cut ties with Palantir. So they have been pushing Chaps Vision for a few years now, and this announcement will open a period of progressive adaptation. So Palantir will progressively leave the intelligence services to leave the room for Chaps Vision, which could take between 1 and 3 years, according to the French government.
So it hasn't been a sudden break.
It has been a sudden break with the announcement, but actually, it's a larger dynamic that has been going on in France and even in Europe for the past few years.
What role in this decision has been played by United States legislation, the Cloud Act?
Well, it's something that's really important in the way the French government sees dependencies with US services, because services that are under the Cloud Act have the obligation to deliver data to the US government when asked to. So it is, of course, a big factor of uncertainty, which governments are less and less willing to take. So, of course, it's really at the center of the strategy of trying to diverse from those companies. But the question it opens is, do European companies that are settled to compete with Palantir, are they at the same level? Do they offer the same products? Because, of course, we are talking about intelligence services that need very high quality data, and so it's very sensitive.
The Cloud Act, for a moment, Sian, did that mean that information that Palantir was analysing for the French domestic intelligence service of about, say, ISIS terrorism in France, that that information was available to the United States because an American company was analysing it?
Well, it's the big question, because we have very little views over what Palantir actually shares with the US government. So, of course, it's a big factor, as I said, of uncertainty. And you still have this question pending, which is how much information the US government could get on both the terrorists groups that can be active in France, and both the way the French authorities handle them actually have. So it's, yeah, it's really at the center of this discussion.
Oceana, are you aware of any times when United States authorities have used the Cloud Act to get information from the French security services?
Well, it has not been publicized, so we don't know exactly if it happened or not. But that's definitely one of the risks that could land on such contracts.
Another of the problems for France, as I understand from your reporting, is that Palantir is enormously expensive.
Yes, it is. And it's, I mean, as most of those services that are used by the governments are. So, of course, it's very expensive, and it's an area where governments are really able to put a lot of money, because, as we said, they need like high quality data and systems that can treat them very efficiently. So yes, it is.
Was there any embarrassment also around the figure of the founder of Palantir, Peter Thiel?
Well, that's not said explicitly, but we know that Peter Thiel is very close to the US administration, and he's also a figure that's quite controversial. He has a lot of takes about, let's say, the good and the bad, and it has a whole discourse about the Antichrist. So he's been a public figure that's hard to pinpoint, and actually he's been in France a few months ago for a conference on those topics, and it was quite a debate just to actually host him and have him speaking in Paris. But it's not, yeah, as I said, it's not explicitly linked to his personality, but of course it can play a role in the way he's perceived and his company is perceived.
Sian, I could never get enough about the Antichrist. What was he saying? What was he saying about the Antichrist?
Well, Peter Thiel has a whole theory about the fact that we are seeing possibly the rise of a new Antichrist. So he spoke in a high-level conference in Paris. It was in January. So his concern is that the Antichrist, the modern Antichrist, spreads rumors about war, and that they spread the idea that artificial intelligence can lead to a totalitarian movement. So, I mean, in that category, for example, he puts Greta Thunberg, which is, of course, the climate activist. So
she's an Antichrist.
She's part of this movement.
I thought he might have been heading to a tender identification of Donald Trump as the Antichrist.
Well, he's someone who has quite conflicting views in this, and he actually also went to the Vatican to spread those words, where he was quite coldly welcomed, but it didn't stop him from trying to get influence over this debate.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Océane Herrero, a reporter for Politico in Paris, about the assertion by European governments of what they call data sovereignty. Océane, the French government, and I think the German government as well, are also distancing themselves from Microsoft. Now, what's that about?
Well, it's the same problem with the Cloud Act that is a problem for both the French and the German government when it comes to Microsoft, because there is also this issue of possibly having transfers of data from American companies to the American government. And one of the, let's say, wake-up calls was when one of the prosecutors of the International Criminal Court, which is Clément Guillot, which is French, has been denied access to his Microsoft email account, and also other American services. So it really gave the idea or actually made it substantial that there could be a kill switch with American companies having to shut down services for some European users. So as for Palantir, it's been a debate that's been around for a few years, but recent news and the policies of the new American administration make this very much more relevant with time. So France and Germany are progressively trying to cut ties with those services and trying to find replacements. So it has been, for example, for the French government trying to replace video conferencing services that are used in the government, like Teams or Zoom or others, by a French service, which is Visio. So it's all those efforts that are supposed to lower the dependency on those American services.
Just on that question of the sanctioning of one of the prosecutors of the ICC, the International Criminal Court, this is the action that is taken by the United States on behalf of Israel, for the most part, it appears. And Francesca Albanese, another figure who has been sanctioned in this way, cut off from all of their bank accounts. I hadn't realised that it also cut them off from their email.
Yeah, it's a very broad ban, actually, because it's a lot of American services that we use every day. And once a decree issued by the American president bans you from them, you find yourself quite lost, because how do you function right now without an email address or without banking services? It's really complicated. So, of course, it has been something that's sparked a new debate on those dependencies.
Microsoft appears to have sort of denied this was happening for a time. Are they still denying it?
Well, yes, they deny for a long time, and now it's not something that they publicly enjoy to comment. But it's definitely something that will stick to them and really influence the way the debate is shaping in the coming months.
Are other European countries following suit, following what France and Germany have done in ditching Microsoft?
Well, it's progressive, but at the same time, the European legislation is also evolving in a way that would make the EU less dependent on those services. So they have, for example, a cloud sovereignty framework that's supposed to lessen the dependency on those companies that are under foreign law exposure. So there is an evolution on this, but at the same time, it's something that's, of course, very sensitive because the American government knows that American companies get a lot of value from public contracts in Europe. So it's something that's a part of a broader negotiations around commercial ties and dependencies.
Very profitable. You've also written about AI and a meeting between big tech companies and G7 leaders recently in France discussing AI. What has been the upshot of that?
Well, it's this debate came at a very interesting moment. So it was a lunch that was organized by the French government with the leaders of the G7 countries and CEOs from tech companies, among them Sam Altman from OpenAI, Dario Amodei from Anthropic, but also Arthur Mensch from the French company Mistral. And the goal was to open a debate around global regulation of AI. But it came at a moment where the American government just had banned new models from the company Anthropic from to be used by users that are not American. And Anthropic decided to shut down the model completely because they thought it was not possible to do this distinction. So it came at this moment where Europe was wondering if the US saw them as a threat or as an ally. And they tried to, let's say, play the part of saying that they are allies and that they can work together on making those models secure and, let's say, keep an open line with the US in trying to get a word in the way the new AI models will be shared with the world. And it's really part of the same discussion on access on technology.
But it's still, at this point, simply a discussion.
Well, it's a discussion, yes, at this point, because in the end, it's the U.S. government that still has the upper hand on whether or not the most powerful models, because they are American, are accessible to the rest of the world or not.
But Europe must be developing its own AI.
Well, France has been developing also its own ecosystem of AI models and AI companies. I talked about Mistral. It's really one of the companies that are concentrating the hopes of both the French government and also a bit of the European Union to be able to, let's say, have their own models, but also have a word in the regulation discussion, because if you don't have any companies and if you don't have power in this, let's say, AI race, it's harder to be listened to.
Oh, brave new world. Océane, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live. I've been talking to Océane Herrero, reporter for Politico in Paris, about the movement in Europe for asserting digital sovereignty. Coming up, trees are taking over Italy. The Italian countryside was a mighty garden cultivated for thousands of years, but the land is being abandoned, and a new report, Foreste in Comune, reveals that forests now cover more than a third of the country, nearly 11 million hectares. It's no win for the environment. The report has just been published by an NGO called PEFC, and that stands for Programme for the Endorsement of Forest Certification. Its Secretary General is Antonio Brunori, and he joins me now from Perugia. Antonio, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Antonio, is the return of forest a mark of poverty?
This is what people think. That means more forest you have, that means that more people left the place, and therefore there is a poverty situation. Our report entered into the details, and we found out that one third of the most forested area are even richer than other municipality in the valley. And like that, we were able to react to the paradigm that says less people and mountain area are poor, and in the valley are the industry, so there is more money running. It is true. This is the majority of the situation. But there are counter tendons. I don't know if it's correct in English. There is a different way of seeing in certain area where more forest means more quality of life and is a kind of a climatic refuge. That means people that are dying of heat in the city, they prefer to transfer themselves in mountain area where it's more fresh air, there is a slow pace of culture, and there is higher quality of life, let's say.
Antonio, where the forests are regrowing is mainly in mountainous areas, is that correct?
Yes, this is the situation. In the last 100 years, the Italian forest surface doubled its number, and all the forests are growing in mountain and hilly area. And that's because many dwellers, many inhabitants of mountain area went down into big cities that are located in the valley. This disappearance of people make the environment to regrow. The forests are growing 5 meters per year towards valley. And this is good from the ecosystem services point of view because you have more photosynthesis, you have more CO2 stocked into the plants, you have more oxygen, you have more biodiversity, etc. But this growth of a forest in mountain area is not planned. It is abandonment, and that creates more problems because forest fire are entering faster in such dense pioneer forest. There are even phenomena of landslide because when you have so much trees all packed together, because I remember they are pioneer trees. They are not the stable climax ecosystem, okay? So this become heavy when it is very much raining because the climate change now, there are extreme situation of raining. So the mountains fell down. And that's because there are too many forests. It's incredible to say, but this is the actual situation.
So the forest isn't these new forests. They're not valuable timber.
Indeed, it is like that. We have young trees, so small stems, and is timber that has low value in the timber market. In 20, 30 years from now, this ecosystem will be developed in much higher forest. New species will enter, and these new species will be more valuable. We are talking about broadleaves, for example, that are used by furniture sector. But that will be in 20, 30, 40 years from now. Now, those species are valuable for fuel wood, for energy purposes only. So that is why the new forests are good from the environment point of view, but not for the economy. That is the situation. So somehow we have to manage this new forest, maybe finding new economies such as forest bathing situation, such as payment for ecosystem services or other new market, not only timber market.
Antonio, this is just being allowed to happen. I mean, nobody is clearing the regrowth. It's just happening.
Yeah.
So who owns this land? Who owns these forests? Is anybody taking any care of them?
Good question, David. In Italy, 65% of forest area is private. 35% is public. this 65% that I was telling you, most of this forest, the owner don't know to own a forest. And you know why? Because more than 100 years ago, many people from Veneto, Tuscany, Calabria, Campania, you know those regions, many people went to United States, to Australia, to South America, Argentina, or to Germany to work. So now most of the people that are living in Australia or in the United States, their ancestors were coming from my country, but now the people in the second generation of Italian in Australia don't know if they own or not some land or some forest. And this is the situation. We don't have a clear idea in the cadastre of who is the owner of that specific forest. So it's not easy to manage, for example, a landslide or a forest fire, because you cannot enter in private owner land. So the new legislation is trying to manage this terrible situation, because you cannot do anything in a big mountain. Probably you know 20 owners out of 1,000 owners.
Yes, I mean, we hear out here about people coming to Australia after they've been to America and Canada, tracking down the owners of blocks of land in Italy. And they search for 20, 30 people who own a beautiful block of land on the sea. And they sign them up in order that that block can be sold. It's a business. I don't know whether anybody's going to bother doing it for regrowth forest, but if it's beautiful seaside land, that business is going on all the time, because there are dozens and dozens of owners for every block.
Yeah, it's true. You take a picture of a situation. The point is that if it is a beautiful land, it has a value. But if you had pasture or even a small lot of forest, and now it's everything changed and is new regrowth forest, or it is an abandoned old forest, the value is less than half euro per meter. So per square meter. So in the end, it's more valuable for 1 hectare than money for the accountant or for the technician than the money you receive, because the land is very poor in their value.
Yes, yes.
So the situation is, from economic point of view, is not so clear. It's not valuable the time you spend to find out where is your land of your ancestors.
Yes, yes, yes. On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr. I'm talking to Antonio Brunori from the Italian Forest Certification Program about the forests that are slowly covering Italy. Antonio, what will the new legislation do? What is it designed to do?
Okay, what it's doing, it is that the mayor of a municipality will do the work trying to contact all the forest owner or of a land owner. And it gives 6 months' time to respond. If there are silent owners, as the law says, that don't reply, the mayor will work on that land, for example, to do some thinning to reduce the forest fire hazard, or to build some road to reduce the danger of some landslide. If the owner in 10 years will ask, why you work in my land? I want the money back. The mayor will give him the money according to the surface of the owner that reclaim that area. And after that period, if nobody asks for any revenues, those money goes into the municipality budget,
yes,
to do more environmental activities. So this is the new legislation. It's 2018, and it is called the Forest Law. And the Forest Law is 100 years after the previous one, because at that time we had only 4 million hectares of forest, and everything was to protect those forests. Now we have around 11 million hectares, maybe 12, because this is also the number from our report, is close to 12 million hectares in 2025. And that means three times more than 100 years ago. And the new law is considering the fact that most of the land is abandoned. So private are not showing their hands. Therefore, public must do something for the reduction,
yes,
of big forest fire hazard or landslide.
Antonio, what do Italians think of this land being abandoned, of forests regrowing there? Does it fill them with, sadness, despair, or is it something that they've come to accept as inevitable?
83% of Italians live in urban area. And this process is just in the last 50 years. So urban people watch at forest like a picture, like a postcard image. So they really don't have such a sensibility of the fact that it's abandoned or it's managed. Only the 17% of Italian people, we are 60 million, that you can understand, is, yes, let's say less than 15 million people, knows that the forest area is growing and creating a problem. So they shout and say, do something. There is so more wild boar and more deer than people in the mountains now. So there is a strong complaint, but politicians are talking to urban people because the votes are there. And therefore, Italians want to have the urban area managed properly. So no holes in the street, water in, yes, area, whatever. So there is not much such a sensibility towards the mountain area. That is the point. Now, most of the people live in municipality with 0% forest. So they go to the mountain area where there are a lot of forest, and they want it like in a commercial hall. So they want to arrive to have all the services prepared. But this is only in summer for the mountain area, or in winter for the skiing area. So you see, the request of having mountain area good for the internet services, for the water, for the food, is only on seasonal,
yes,
situation.
Yes.
And that's complicate the request of,
they
of
want,
people.
They want everything they can get in the city, up in the hills, in the forest, when they go
very
on
good
holidays.
Synthesis.
Yes, I can understand that. But Antonio, with the return of the trees, is, you mentioned deer a moment ago, is there also a return of wildlife? What about wild boars, wolves, perhaps?
Yeah, this is the situation. You have to know that wildlife now is increasing so much that wolves are entering into the city. Even situation in which bear, the brown bear, killed some people, but it's not because they are so wild and ferocious. It's because people now go in the forest running like they are in an urban area, or they bring their dogs. And so if you meet some wolves or some bear, then it's a problem. And so, you know, the arrogance of urban people is, I am in danger, kill the wolf, kill the brown bear. And this is really something in Trentino area that the president of the region received even personal attack because he was saying, kill the bear, just because one bear was harassing the villagers in the valley. So you raise a good question. More urban people are entering in the wild area, but they want to have the situation safe like they are in urban area.
They want to be able to jog through the forest without being attacked by a brown bear. Now, Antonio, that's perfectly reasonable.
Oh, yes, it's perfectly reasonable, but we should be educated. If you enter in the house of somebody else to say, knock, knock, hello, can I enter? And then following the rules of the people who give you hospitality. So if you enter in a forest where wildlife is the majority, we don't have to be so arrogant to do what we do in city and go into the forest and continue to be like a citizen. You understand what I mean? So this is something that is not only a societal challenge. It is a question of urban people who enter in area that are lived by mountain people with different rhythm, with different culture, different reasoning. And people from urban area enter in a village, in mountain, and they complain because there is not fresh bread, because the internet is not working, and where can I park my car, etc. So, you see, we are moving now from bear or wolf to the Homo sapiens inhabitant of the forest areas. That means man that have different culture of the urban area. I don't know if I'm complicating now the picture, but what we are facing now, it is a real challenge that is done by climate change, demographic crisis, because in mountains, nobody is born anymore. So it's only old people. And the fact that people from urban area want their style of life going even in areas that are abandoned. Do I give you a picture? Because, okay, Italy was the niche of the culture since 3,000 years ago, Etruscan, Romans, blah, blah, blah. But now we are 60 million in 20% of the land. The rest of the land is with only few million people. And we need immigration. We need more people who are cultivating the land, that are giving food for the pasture, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Antonio, the picture is very clear. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. I've been talking to Antonio Brunori from the Italian Forest Certification Program about the return of the forest to Italy. The PEFC has a sister organisation in Australia. Its name, Responsible Wood. And that's the show. On our next, Bruce Shapiro is back to preview this weekend's celebrations of the US 250th birthday. Oh, the speeches, the fireworks, the Freedom 250 Grand Prix in the streets of the national capital, and over it all, the hovering presence of Donald J. Trump. They sure know how to kick up their heels in the land of the free. Plus, we are looking at cactus smuggling in Mexico and Japan trying to rebuild its army and finding it just doesn't have enough young people. That's next.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.